Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the opening keynote address of the ISBSO's 2013 annual meeting. My name is Manny Scher. I'm really grateful to the organizing committee for inviting me to host this presentation of Kathy White's paper, The Price of the Fear of Fading, Some Thoughts on Women's Resistance to Taking the Role of Elder from a Psychoanalytic Perspective. Kathy and I have been friends and colleagues since 1978, when we were somewhat lost and anxious younger members of the Leicester Conference. 8 years later, in 1986, Kathy was my small study group consultant at Leicester. And 14 years later, I was Kathy's director at the Leicester Conference. And then, in 2007, we decided together that we would go as members to the ACRI Boston Conference, where under the direction of Sharla Hayden, we both basked in the contentment and fought off the terrors of being the grandparents of the conference. So in many ways, Kathy and I have aged together, and we seem to be fading together, while sharing an abiding commitment while having an abiding commitment for bringing on the next generation in our kind of work. The organizing committee could not have created a more intense faithfulness and joy than pairing an African-American woman from New York with a Jewish white male from Johannesburg, South Africa, for this opening keynote plenary. Kathy is a well-known psychoanalyst, a craft she has practiced for many years. She's known locally and internationally as a renowned organizational development consultant, a leadership consultant, a leadership development consultant, and an executive coach, working on many striking assignments, including being an advisor to the election team that saw President Obama return to the presidency in 2012. The plan for this meeting is that Kathy will address us for about 40 to 45 minutes, following which we will have about 30 minutes for thoughtful dialogue with each other and with Kathy. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Kathy White.
Very much. It feels just wonderful to be here and to see all of my old friends, long time ago friends, and new friends that I'm making. And because I'm working on a new computer here, I'm just trying to get my place. But anyway, I'm very much looking forward to the conversation that we'll have after I speak. Many of you have come up to me to say, can't wait. Just the right topic. So I want to know what it is that's getting stirred up. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to think about an aspect of generativity, that is, taking on the role of elder, with colleagues who are on the giving, developing, and receiving end of this developmental competency. I do think our society, ISPSO, by reason of its existence, as well as reason of the learning opportunities it provides, is making it possible to further develop and pass on this generative competency. I'm also delighted to be hosted by Manny, who many of us know has recently set an example on transitioning to eldership by managing a smooth transfer of power and authority to a next generation leader of the Tavistock Institute, Eliyot Aram. He has taken his place as elder. While this presentation focuses on women and our nuanced complexities in transitioning into the role of elder, I'm very aware that men work to make this transition as well. I know a bit about Manny's challenges that existed when he made his transition to elder. I'd love to know the experiences of other men and learn whether there is a pattern or a dynamic from which we can learn. The future of our work rests completely in the hands and hearts and minds of our next generation. In my mind, the role of elder is critical to this development. With the support and care of this aspect of future through transmissions of wisdom and authority within formal protege relationships. Transmissions also occur through an elder attitude and stance which can empower accidental protégés who are learning by observing how we take up this key role in their development. Like any intergenerational transmission, what we teach will be what they teach. This paper suggests that the role of elder is a developmental stage competency that most of us, women and men alike, approach in a state of ambivalence. The stage is associated with an unwelcome return of identity crises, which we fear may overwhelm and diminish the delights of seniority and eldership. One can find oneself in a state of resistance to engaging the complexities and challenges involved in inhabiting the role of elder, and can become, become more preoccupied with staving off shifts in self-perception with indifferent, muted, or no awareness of the intergenerational impact of the developmental struggle. My experience of working with female patients, female clients, as well as my experience of friends and of myself, tell me that some women may exhibit and experience this role resistance in a particular way. A woman patient of mine coined a phrase for this state that we women can find ourselves in. It had such a tremendous impact and resonance with me, and it also clarified some of the fuzzy thinking I was having about age-mate patients and clients that I was working with. She described the state as being in the throes of fear of fading. Unlike other fears associated with senior development, the fear of fading can be thought of as a fear of living, a dread of having to continue on with an altered state of self as regarded by oneself and from altered cues coming from the rest of the external world around one. The fear manifestations themselves can have tremendous impact on actual protégés and can be significant deterrent to one being alive to opportunities to transmit wisdom or to transmit authority to accidental protégés. This paper attempts to tease out the issues and demonstrate the effects of the fear of fading through a vignette from consulting practice and from my personal experience, to develop some hypotheses to normalize understanding of this transmission through stage-related resistance to growth, and to develop some thoughts on working through the resistance to bring a woman elder to being a woman elder that we may use for ourselves throughout our work with women and where it might apply to our work with men. So I had an awakening. When I took on the theme of this conference, the future of our work and the work of our future, some preconscious experiences kind of began to jolt to full awareness, and they still have strength of presence. There are three. The first one is that I'm aware that I'm not the future. Although my family genetics let me imagine productive years ahead, those years feel more finite than they did just a few years ago. When that idea comes to mind, I take an internal check of my relatedness, my mental health, my physical state, and my productivity. Check, 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 and check. I'm doing okay for now. I took a check like this some time ago when I was making the transition from being a practicing psychoanalyst to practicing applied psychoanalysis. Check, 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 and check. Things were way out of kilter. I had to ask myself what the hell I was doing working on a consulting team pretty much for acceptance and inclusion in my male colleagues' inner circle and for bragging rights. We were working in an organization that I knew operated offshore facilities in ways that violated many of the labor laws that we hold dear. When the awareness hit me, I remembered my lesson. Back in the day, a local judge in Chicago, Judge Thomas, introduced Martin Luther King to six of us black college freshmen home from Thanksgiving. We were in the basement of a Baptist church having Southern fried post-service conversation. After quite a lovely exchange about our studies and our aspirations, Dr. King told us kids, "The dream is in your hands." He was telling us that we were the future. The mandate inside of that blessing was that one had to measure one's self and one's life pursuits against the standard of being a contributor to societal well-being. So my work in that consulting team, I was not contributing to well-being. On the contrary, I was adding to societal distress. While I'm not the future, I have all the lessons that, having been the future, to guide me and to pass on if I'll let it happen. The second thing that comes to mind when I think about our annual meeting theme, I find myself musing on the question of what is my legacy? What is the legacy from experiences of teaching, training, being a psychoanalyst, applying psychoanalysis? What is it? To be more accurate, what I would like to say is, what do I want my legacy to be? And this is a bit of folly. Maybe it's an aspect of transitioning to eldership, knowing that one is not the future. The folly is that it seems I'm wishing that I actually could have control over how people will hold me in their minds later on. However, the truth is, by now, my legacy is already in place, and I think that part of my later stage developmental work is to have the courage to look around and figure out what I have wrought and perhaps do a bit of tweaking, certainly take some accountability. There is an adage in psychoanalysis that guides me here, and the adage says, look around your practice and see what developmental issues you're working on. Finally, and third thing, wake up as a result of pondering the annual meeting theme. I find myself often in high irritability with quite unusual people recently. I'll give you an example. There is a woman colleague with whom I've been working for about a dozen years, where I have been repeatedly disappointed in her lack of maturity, especially around being able to manage some interpersonal and professional boundaries. Our conversations about how to align our ways of working inevitably fall into a struggle about who's got the best ideas, whose ideas have the best merit. This constant struggle between us interferes with the smooth running of team business and leaves us both exhausted and dissatisfied. Our team colleagues are sick to death of us. In order to better align ourselves, we've had many conversations, and I'll tell you the result of the most potent for me. She said, in summary, actually, that I had not been able to let her learn from me because I was constantly in competition with her. She had wanted to be my protege, these are her words, both in group relations work and in psychoanalytic applications that I use in our teamwork. However, I was treating her more like a competitive peer with expectations around her poise, confidence, and experience. Since she could not live up to what felt like an unreasonable expectation for her to be 20 years more mature than she was and older than she was, the only thing left for her to do with me was to fight for her own space, her own age, and her own identity. I happened to be 18 years older than this woman. Whether I had something to offer or not, she experienced herself as being at risk of taking in my projections and perhaps becoming damaged by my envy. Well, this was stunning. I took her comments to have been a powerful interpretation of the dynamics of my resistance to taking on the role of elder. My colleague's interpretation, along with my emergent bits of awareness lately, have cracked the armor of my resistance. I see the ways in which I discourage some parts of our future from thinking of me as a developmental resource. There are a couple of examples just to highlight the point. There is a man in group relations who has been saying for years, "Kathy, you are my group relations mama. I wish you would claim me. I'm doing interesting work. I would love to engage you in thinking about things." The capstone of these examples of my resistance is a refrain from a young colleague who actively thinks of herself as my protege. She has claimed me, and she has responded to my inevitable critiques, read dubiousness about her innovative ideas with this thought: "Kathy, I don't need you to be smart. I need you to be wise." Good on her, right? These small examples, among many, I'm afraid, roll up to a picture of my style of combating fading to disappearance by withdrawal, or most often by heightened aggressive competitiveness. Having taken this full on board, I can see the dynamics at play. These are the same strategies I use to separate from a would-be engulfing mother all those developmental steps ago. I had to remove myself from her sphere of influence in order to win, as well as to avoid the consequences of winning. I could help her contain her displeasure with me and help her contain her envy at my being successful without her, by not flinching when she attributed my successes to herself. My daddy and me, we knew the difference. We knew it better. My own vignette reminds me of an area of study begging to be undertaken, that is, the psychological consequences for women who have been Oedipal winners. One scenario is when the father is both a maternal object as well as the object of Oedipal desire and longing in a young girl, all to the father's great delight. His preference for her and unwavering support of his projected female self-ideal is the manifestation of the daughter's supremacy in the age-old mother-daughter struggle. One could say that the girl's identification with and patterning of values after her father gives evidence of an interjected male parent around whom identity has formed. The term I use to describe this developmental outcome in adulthood is male-identified women. And by the way, this has nothing to do with sexual preference. It only describes patterning of values. My analytic and consulting practices over the years lead me to understand that public success, accomplishment, achievement by women often can be accompanied by or associated with some aspect of male identification. I have seen two facets of this dynamic gem. If the identification in an early is an early compensation strategy for felt experience of maternal absence, it may leave the girl with an uneasy identification with father, laced with rage at the maternal abandonment. Seen this many times in practice, the executive woman who is succeeding with what is thought of as a male-like aggressiveness can be in a defensive stance against intense maternal longing. Since her relatedness style tends to deprive her of adult versions of that, the stage is set for repetition. If the identification results from early family dynamics that one might describe as a girl's Oedipal winning, where values and identity patterning are paternal in nature, it may leave the girl with an easier paternal identification, but with a characteristic style influenced by maternal longing, and shows up as guilt and feelings of fraudulence, and often difficulty in fully owning impact and success. This can be seen in women who are not achieving to their full potential, or women whose preference is what we could call leading from behind. These early identification strategies have a consequence for maternal relatedness and require a balancing strategy that holds the maternal envy at bay, a daughter's vividness, stage-related success, positive attributions, being the center of appreciation, etc., affords mother a source of gratification through her identification with a vivid offspring. This very incomplete description of an ordinary family dynamic, the one I am contending needs attention of specific research on the impacts of later stage development of women, the one I know well, anecdotally, from practice, leads me to a hypothesis about a woman's fear of fading. Fear of fading is associated with the experience of the fear of retribution from an internalized envious mother. One quite successful woman client put it this way when she finally agreed to announce her retirement and name her successor. She said, "All I have accomplished is a sham and trash. I really should kill myself because I am a fraud after all, and people say that I've done these wonderful things, but I can't see that it amounts to much. Mother would be happy now. She's giggling in her grave. She predicted this, or she wished this on me, or whatever." The encounter with the internalized envious mother is avoided in order to forestall a significant decline in psychological and emotional stamina, to forestall a pull to retire in place, being left with little sense of developmental future, without emotional availability for one's potential successors. In this debilitated condition, one is likely to be given to feelings of envy and hatred towards successors of all sorts, replaying the early Oedipal struggle, but this time identification with the Oedipal loser. One often hears the refrain in women, "Oh my God, I'm turning into my mother." This dynamic state of affairs bears further, deeper understanding so that we can develop concepts, understanding, and interventions to help unlock some women's generativity from the grasp of debilitating fear of living. Recently, Susan Long and I had a conversation about two of our protégés coming into their own. Do you notice how well they're doing? Their names are appearing everywhere. I feel delighted, proud, and horrified, I wrote. Susan responded in a most wonderful Susan way that you recognize, and that is she wrote a poem. And she's given me permission to read the poem. "When I was young, the world was bright. I could rage, I could dance in the light. Life extremists, love and fear, but that was before I began to disappear. Eyes that look but do not see, smiles for everyone but not for me, I'm a ghost, although I am here ever since I began to disappear. Red rivers run dry. I have a desert from neck to my thigh. I'm in a crowd with no cheer since the day, since the day, since the day I began to disappear. Like a mat on the floor, I'm the entry of everyone's door. And like the house that's made of cards, my soul is shattered into many shards. Like a messenger unseen or the echo of a forgotten queen. Red rivers run dry. I have a desert from my neck to my thigh. I'm in a crowd with no cheer since the day, since the day, since the day I began to disappear. I don't want to cry. I don't want to lay down and die. I will reappear. No one can make me disappear. But red rivers run dry. I have a desert from my neck to my thigh. I'm in a crowd with no cheer since the day, since the day, since the day I began to disappear. I love this poem. It brought to mind... Yes. It brought to mind another possible consequence of a dynamic fear of fading, with a psychological imperative to hold on to iconic identity. Head and brains must be preserved, possibly at the expense of heart and passion. These themes concerning nuances around fear of fading show up in many places in my work. I've chosen the following vignette to illustrate ideas I'm presenting because it's still, you know, alive in my heart and still alive in the client. Anne is the founding president and CEO of a medium-sized institution. She began building this organization when her husband died. As they had had a common interest in the arts, she wanted to memorialize this meaningful part of their relationship by building an institution that would become his and her legacy. She gathered up an experienced researcher from a European museum, Francois, to be creative director. She brought in her personal secretary, Mary, to manage administration. Together with herself as curator, the three people oversaw the bricks and mortar development, developed the museum's artistic signature, and started the business of expanding the foundational art collection. The museum opened several years ago. In the early days, Anne particularly relied on Francois to understand her vision and to expand the collection. Since she wanted to dedicate part of the organization's resources to the community in which she had built the museum, she delegated outreach to the community to him. This arrangement was perfect for a startup. Three people totally dedicated to the success of an idea, three people who did the nights and weekends required and did them happily. Their tight bonds held for a time until the organization began to grow. And of course, their bonds became stressed. This is not an unusual scenario. The heart of the matter was that Anne's realization that the artistic vision of her creative director was not evolving with the many opportunities now available to the larger organization. In addition, Francois had been made executive director to manage the many new staff having come on board. It became clear that Francois' managerial skills were basically non-existent. In an attempt to bring him along, Anne provided him with many resources as possible to help him learn in place, including graduate-level coaching, graduate-level training and executive coaching by a local retired businessman. All to no avail. Francois' interests were to continue in creative partnership with Anne, to grow the institution and develop his own legacy as co-creator of what might become a famous institution. He was not interested in the nuts and bolts of daily management and felt entitled to ownership of a co-creative leadership position with all of its perks and choices, etc. Francois' stance was far out of touch with the working needs of the organization. It was deeply distressing to Anne to face the fact that she was going to have to let Francois go. This tug on her sense of loyalty and fair play couldn't be diminished by the offering of a golden parachute. However, it was either face the feelings and bite the bullet or harm the institution. Although Anne's through Anne's contacts and with her extensive help, Francois successfully transitioned to a comparable role in Europe. The organization, having been mired down in sentient tensions, began to enliven once he was gone. Anne assumed the interim role of the executive director. The chairman of the board, Jim, agreed that the board development was critically needed to provide guidance. The board deficiencies and needs, which had been made obvious during this difficult transition, came under discussion in our three-way conversations. I made queries on our network about the availability of talent to do board transformation work in preparation to help with this effort. I continued in my role as consultant to Anne in her multiple roles and to the board chair and Anne as they worked through the decisions for the next critical stage of the museum's need to grow and grow robustly. This work went along smoothly as Anne and Jim were determined to get things back on track. As advice-giving, coaching, advising work with Anne and the organization began to wind down, I felt there was one area that we had neglected to approach that had become glaringly obvious during our conversations. The plan to have Anne in multiple roles, founding president, member of the board, company CEO, curator, and now executive director, was not sustainable beyond an interim when searches could be undertaken and hires could be made. It wasn't sustainable as a long-term solution in any event, despite her interest in staying at the helm, now that she had the taste of being at the helm, in charge of all, she had developed the sense of she could hold the whole. It wouldn't be sustainable because Anne at the time was in her mid-70s. I opened the conversation with her about succession, who in the family might be talented and interested, who on the board might be talented and interested, where might she consider finding interest and talent. The board development process could take some time. How does she think about her role in bringing them recommendations, etc.? Anne's response was, there's plenty of time for that, and I also have an if I get hit by the bus plan. Her CFO, longtime family friend and trusted advisor, would take the helm as CEO while the board worked on permanent solutions. She said that she would focus on succession when the transition period had subsided and the board developed enough to take the matter under consideration. I pushed her a bit on what domain she might be looking for likely prospects, but it wasn't a conversation that had any traction. In my final meeting with Anne and Jim, I offered my availability if they needed my services in the transitions to come. We ended more than amicably, except that I felt there was work with Anne that was incomplete. For quite a while, I couldn't figure out what it was and what felt unfinished. But it dawned on me sometime later that I was developing a hypothesis which, in good conscience and out of respect to her and for my professional sense of making a contribution, I would have to give her. I invited Anne to lunch meeting in the museum town, telling her that I had a hypothesis about her future and about the future of the museum, and I wanted to run it by and discuss it with her. Was she interested? She was very interested. When we met, I told her the following set of ideas truncated for our conversation. I said, having been curious about your early family life throughout our various bits of work over the 18 months, I have developed enough of a picture to be able to offer you these ideas. I think you would rather risk the museum going dark, snuff out after you're gone, rather than for you to experience the losses if you were to take the steps to exit stage left. Who would you be then if you are not the well-known entrepreneur becoming the darling of the museum world? What would you do with yourself? And of course, your mother would be satisfied in her grave, knowing that her prediction about your not coming to much would be realized. She warned you. I think you, I'm beginning to understand, in my own experience as a woman, senior and elder, that it is extremely painful to give over who you have been to someone else, to see yourself only through the bits of you that remain embedded in the protege, who is fashioning, after all, a new version of self. Stepping aside might occasion an envious attack, if not from the sidelines, then certainly from that mother inside you who told you long ago that you wouldn't amount to much. As she said, a son would have tried to be like father, not a daughter. Anne's father was a successful entrepreneur, and he had always encouraged Anne to be bold. I finished up by saying, the museum could go dark. Your struggle to hold on to your sense of being a person of value and as a contributing value in the culture could go dark along with it. This turned out to be elicit very important thoughts from Anne. She had indeed been musing about what it would be like if the museum didn't exist. Would she feel guilty for having destroyed part of herself, or would she feel relief at not having to stay on her high-performing track? Did she deserve to lose it all, as has been predicted? I offered to spend some time with her thinking through both what it would mean to start to fade, as well as to think about whom it might be that she could bring along and stay alive herself at the same time. Keeping in mind the issues of legacy, I asked her who in the family would have the stuff that she has in order to do this work, personality, drive, brains, etc. Turns out she has a grandniece by marriage, who has shown a good deal of interest in the organization. She was very supportive during the early days of the startup. She was present at all the ceremonial events and curious person. She was a diamond in the rough that Anne could help polish up and bring along. Anne said at a subsequent meeting, this might be fun. To sum up, Anne had positioned herself to potentially miss out on directly mentoring, guiding, empowering, authorizing, and passing on much of what was dear about herself to the next generation in order to stave off fears of what could happen to her if she were to fade, the worst of which would be fulfilling a prediction deposited in her long ago when she was learning to be bold. Now, having committed to make a contribution to the future of her dream, she has risen out of the kind of depressive place she was in, and her sense of self-worth has heightened. She is better prepared to bear her own experience of envious feelings toward her grandniece. She has requisite awareness to avoid sabotaging the protege, we hope. Most importantly, she may have enough awareness to avoid sabotaging herself before all the role transitions can be put in place. And for my money, she could stop skateboarding before she kills herself. I want to tell you a bit about my personal experience of trying to correct for the fear of fading. When my protege said, "Kathy, I don't need you to be smart, I need you to be wise," it had the impact of being a consultation to my role. I understood that I had work to do in order to pull back my resentment, to discontinue my avoidance, to discontinue my neutral to unfriendly stance regarding her innovative ideas. I understood that in order to do that, I had to be transparent with her about a struggle. And I'll sum it up because Manny just gave me the cue. She had been given a role that had been traditionally mine, that is, senior black woman. And an appointment she had been traditionally mine. And it was, you know, terrible. I felt rejected. I felt unloved. I felt abandoned by both the hiring institution and by my protege. But what was worse was that in her recounting of having this honor, she declared herself to be the first black person ever to have the space. I was livid. Oh, God. So I took her to lunch, and after telling her how pleased I was that she had gotten the opportunity, I reminded her that she shared the position of being first, she in one role, me in another, and it was not a singular accomplishment for either of us. We were standing on the shoulders of wonderful, talented elders. I acknowledged the fact that I was working through feeling pissed off, resentment, I said, leading up to this conversation, and telling her this was my way of trying to open up a dialogue between us that would keep our relatedness intact. Interestingly, she had been avoiding me as well for fear that my envy, jealousy, or both would come crashing down on her head and at times when she wouldn't be expecting it. She was also feeling a bit guilty about having, quote, taken something away from me. This was a precious conversation, and it has helped us both explore the feelings associated with intergenerational transmissions. The conversation was timely in her life, as she is facing feelings about her next generations nipping at her heels. And she and a protege have just written a book, and they're having a squabble over first authorship. It was making her feel that she needed to speed up somehow, be smarter somehow, and I told her that she had my complete understanding and empathy. What I understand from this exchange is that the role of elder and the role of protege, these roles are mutually authorizing. So let me conclude. As the future of our work rests completely in the hands, minds, and hearts of the next generation, I have set out to look at one of the impediments to the transition of power and authority and wisdom from female elders to women protégés that would support their ongoing development and ascendancy. I'm calling this impediment a fear of fading, which in a few words means attempts to hold on to power, authority, centrality, preeminence for fear of living with altered ascribed identity and a fear of encountering an envious maternal introject, which could further erode foundational sense of self. I know that there are many variations on the theme of readying oneself to take up the role of elder to help secure the future of our work. I'm looking forward to hearing about that from you, and I'm looking for models, current models, of how to take on the role with vigor, elegance, and grace. My old models, Martin Luther King and Judge Thomas, were fine examples back in the day. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Kathy. I'm going to ask you now to spend a few moments in silence and reflect on some of the ideas, thoughts, and feelings that Kathy has shared with us. If you wish, you may talk to your neighbors, and we'll do that for about 2 to 3 minutes. And then after that, I'm going to ask you to engage in a conversation and dialogues with each other, mostly. Kathy will not respond in the first instance, but she'll gather up some of her own thoughts arising from the conversations and will respond about 7 minutes before the end of the time. Okay, so spend a few minutes alone.
Light to see them shine and to be better than I am, and that's what I leave behind, and that's what maybe helps my fear of fading, because that's right and that's what it should be. They should be the stars.
Thank you.
Over here.
My name is Ruth Silver, and I work in London, although I'm Scottish by birth, and that's significant. Kathy, thank you very much indeed for helping me seeing old things in very new ways and old complications in very new ways. I longed to be an elder. In fact, I bragged about it for a long time before I became one. And that's because the Scottish tradition of have elders in this Church of Scotland. It's not my church, but it is my community. And the kind of idea there is that an elder in Scotland looks after 4 families, and you clear the snow and you wash the newly born and you wash the dead as well. So you are there to be available as a resource according to the family's needs. And I work in the education world, and my fantasy was it would be the same thing for me. And I have involvement in running a leadership centre. And I've noticed 2 things I think I just want to offer as contributions. One is how hard it is for retired principals of colleges and universities to become elders, because they want to pass on the way they did it. Yeah. And it occurs to me there's no holding, there's no waiting lounge, holding mechanism to help people move, actually from being one day the chief executive of a large college to being an elder and being available to support others. So to think about what is that, what's the path, what's the pre-elderhood pathway that we could be working with in leadership centres and so on to be helpful. And the second one is, it just occurred to me as you spoke, and I recognise how hard it is for your woman friend to give up success given her mother didn't expect it of her. And it put me in touch with how hard it is to give up success when you've been everything your parents wanted you to be. Mm. And the pain of that is quite, you know, quite overwhelming. Mm.
Thank you. Anna, over here. Michael.
Yeah, Michael Pavlovich from Germany. I was delighted by your paper and thinking about the ambivalence towards a possible successor, which sometimes may be very difficult, sometimes it is, also very, very good thing to see that the son you have been carrying around says, "Dad, let me take this. It's too heavy for you," things like that. But then I suddenly got another idea. What if there is no successor? I was nobody who wants to come after you, and I was thinking about the diminishing interest in psychoanalysis in Germany. We were 50 candidates in our institute when I was in training. Now we have 12, and I already made the joke, only anyone is allowed to qualify if he brings a new one who takes his place. So what if no successor, if nobody wants to come after you?
I'm Jennifer Petrieri. I live in France, but I'm obviously British. Just building on Michael's points, there were 2 things that struck me in the great talk. One is, what's the role of the other? So what's the role of the successor? And I think one of the dynamics that's going on here is whether successors actually want to succeed or not, and some ambivalence on their part. And then it made me think about that your talk was actually also an organizational interpretation to this room. Because if you look around this room, there is clearly a problem of succession.
Do you have one?
Do I have?
An interpretation to apply to this group.
I think your talk was an interpretation on this group in terms of where are the successors in this room. If you think of a demographic triangle, this is clearly an upside-down room. Yeah. And I wonder if some of the dynamics you talk about have actually been going on in ISPSO that have inverted the triangle. I think that's a dynamic also between the successors, as Michael said.
It's my next paper.
Yes, please.
Yes, I'm Jerry Frum. Thank you, Kathy, for an absolutely beautiful paper. I was thinking about the case you mentioned, and in a sense you could see it as the successful daughter inflicting a fading on a mother whose role is to be mother. When she's left, she's fading. And I found myself thinking about the old Lyman Wynn family concept of the rubber fence. The daughter can go so far, and then at the end feels pulled back into something that's probably not only guilt-driven, but a longing for reunion with the mother she left and with the mother she inflicted fading upon. Mm-hmm. And I can't quite articulate how this makes sense to me, but it seems to me that your daring consultation after the consultation was over, it was a movement against that, almost as though to say to this woman, do you really believe that your mother wished you to end up figuratively childless, the way, you know, you left her childless in a certain sense?
Thank you for that.
And down here, please.
I'm Marina Mojović from Belgrade, Serbia. And thank you very much, Kathy, for... I liked very much your talk. It opening so many important issues for myself as well. First, I liked so much the beginning and the ending with Martin Luther King, and it reminded me as when I was a child of 4 and 5, I went to school to Atlanta, and my parents brought me to a church where he was speaking and Mahalia Jackson singing and the choir. And I didn't understand the words, but something was so strongly transmitted into my internal world, which lives in myself really strongly. And I often think on that. And then I also wanted to mention the complexity. Well, I am the only person in my country bringing this kind of work, ISPSO kind of work, applied psychoanalysis, for, well, more than 10 years, 15 years maybe, slowly, and how complex this is, and the wish for successors is there. There are many young people with a passion. But we, in our small chat, mentioned also having... I have a daughter in the field, and the complexity between some other passion people and my daughter holding a lot of anxiety of attacks on me, which she handles in spite of all the protection I try to give. Just to add to the...
up in the red shirt, gentleman.
Agent Shonda. Dear Kathy, I'd like to thank you for quoting Susan's poem. And I want to thank again Susan for having thought and written the poem.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Nadine?
Hello, Nadine Chelebi, University of the West of England. I'm going to tell you my age. I'm 31. apparently that's young in this society. I would normally not necessarily say that, but I think it's important I say that, because I also have to apologize. I do not understand the perspective from the elder, because I don't know what it feels like. Okay, so just keep that in mind when I say what I say now. I arrived here Tuesday morning, and since then, there is an occurring really strong theme, retirement. So a lot of people seem to be extremely preoccupied with retirement, with aging, exactly what your keynote was about. But what I'm wondering is, we are in the present right now, and why am I being called a successor? I'm a collaborator. What am I supposed to carry forward if there is no older generation teaching me, being a role model for me, working with me? So I must honestly say, the first time I came, the first time and the only other time apart from now I came to ISPSO was in Denmark when I was 28. And there was hardly anybody of the big names, the older names, that approached me. It was extremely difficult for me as a new one, as a younger one, to make any contact. Now, I don't want to generalize because there are a lot of exceptions. But also in this conference now, there are a lot of big names who do not seem to make any effort to get in touch with the new generation. So I think if the theme is past and future, maybe we should concentrate on the present, because I'm here, you are here. So let's make this work. I do want to learn from you.
Thank you. Hannah, Jim Krantz behind you, and we are running out of time. After Jim, there will be only one more opportunity.
And it'll be maybe him.
Yeah. Well, first I want to echo Jerry's appreciation, Kathy. Your lucidity is breathtaking, and I always so moved by it, really. So you have spoken about the way that people work out these issues through their institutions, and it also brings to mind, I think it's connected to your comment too, the way in which institutions work out their issues through people. And there's so many experiences. I have one in mind recently where an institution was trying working out its issues of succession by bringing in and destroying someone, a leader. And I'm just aware of the other side of the cycle, that the institution working through people as well as people working through their issues, working through their institutions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Down here, please. Oh, hello. I'm Margaret Page, also from University of the West of England. So I was really happy to hear from my colleague Nadine over there. I'm holding in mind memories of having been a community worker, and realizing after 8 years of really enjoying that role, that in order to move on, I needed to accept the ephemeral. Not to expect to be able to count up the number of community centers and groups that were thriving, but to accept that they might decide to end. So I'm wondering whether underneath the fear of fading and the block to accepting and to feeling delight at our successors might be defense against the loss of seeing a permanent outcome based on our own notion of success.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Accepting a changing dream.
Thank you.
Yeah. Right. That brings us to the end of the conversation part of today. Now, Kathy's going to spend the next few minutes picking up on some of the threads and responding.
Thank you very much for your thoughts. I do feel like we're in conversation. I love that. I think I want to spend most of my 2.5 minutes speaking about the successors, the protégés, because I did learn that it's a two-way street, this need for communication between the generations. And I think if it hadn't been for... This is Mary, everybody kind of knows that. If it hadn't been for Mary, I wouldn't be given. Given that I'm a person and don't like people too much anyway, it's hard for me to.
Looking at me.
I love you. You're one of the few. Actually, be available when people approach. And what? What's that? Oh, the dog said, okay, hi. I'm here. So anyway, I loved hearing from you. It's like I'm here, elders, but you have the other half of the work to do. I'm looking forward to hearing from you. Any other successors in the room have a point of view they would like to say in the last 30 seconds? Yes.
It's about an issue of prematurity and also what people, the work that people do at different stages. I mean, I keep thinking about some of the people that we inherit from who did their best work in their 60s and 70s. And yet I see the feelings kind of begin sort of in early 60s, thinking you could anticipate to live another 30 years.
I plan to.
Of productive work. So, and sort of, you know, make a distinction between institutional roles, which might end at 65 or 60, and roles within the field, which sometimes make their major contributions later.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've all made very valuable your own assertions about the great value of Kathy and Kathy's paper, which was very moving, very rich, very personal, and sets the tone for the rest of the conference. So thank you, Kathy, on behalf of everybody. It was really special.